Now for something completely different.
Welcome to the Cult of the Clock Tower. I am Andrew Nathanson. Today we're going to be talking about the things we missed in the Bad Moon Rising season. There aren't too many things. In fact, I asked my guests from the season and previous seasons if they had any thoughts they wanted to share. Nobody responded. So I think that means we did a pretty good job. But I do have a few things that I noticed. I think I tend to notice more things because I edit the episodes and have to listen back to them. And sometimes that sparks me thinking about something like, oh, I really wish I had said that. So this is probably going to be a pretty quick episode, but I'm just going to go through a few of these points that I think are interesting ideas and other things like that that were missed, or just new ideas I've had since recording a particular episode. Before I do that, though, I want to talk a little bit about the future of the show, since we are done with all of the characters from the base three scripts. I am not going to be making character-specific episodes about the experimental characters. I might talk about the experimental characters in other ways, but I'm not planning to highlight them in their own episodes until we have a home script released for them. One of my favorite things about Blood on the Clock Tower is the fact that it gives you these three scripts that are all relatively balanced and fun. And you just have those out of the box, and they just work. And for most of these experimental characters, they are only seeing play in custom scripts, which haven't had nearly as much playtesting and are changing a lot. And that means that you get less consistent games with them. And the big thing for my purposes is that you have less of a framework about which you can, or within which you can talk about them. For me, that just makes it a lot harder to talk about the characters. Like, if I'm trying to talk about Goblin and imagine all of the possible interactions with all of the characters, it's far more difficult than the episodes so far where they've just been confined to specific scripts. And Goblin can have very different interactions, just to continue this example, with different characters in different scripts. So even if I'm talking about, like, oh, how do Goblin and Fortune Teller interact? That might be very different depending on what else is on the context of the script. So I don't really feel like I could have a conversation in as much of a productive way about those. So I'd rather just wait until they're all officially released in their own home editions with the expansions, whenever those come out. Which could be a while, but until then, I'm still going to be doing other things. I'm not going to keep up the release schedule of an episode every other week. In fact, I haven't been doing that for a little bit now. My goal is to do about one episode per month. That's just because without the framework of having a specific character to talk about, it's a little bit harder for me to come up with ideas of things that I think are worth an episode. I'm sure I could come up with a lot, but I'm going to just take the pressure off myself to do that every other week schedule and post a little bit more sporadically. I'm still going to generally try to release these on Mondays, so that'll be the same, but no guarantee exactly how many Mondays will pass in between episodes. So with that all being said, let's get into this episode of a few ideas from Bad Moon Rising that weren't mentioned in the show. One idea I wanted to talk about in terms of playing the game as a good player is that, in general, not knowing the number of executions can make execution priority very difficult. So it's just sort of a paradigm shift for Bad Moon Rising in terms of how you think about executions versus the other scripts. In like Trouble Brewing or an SNV, you have a fairly good idea of how many days you have left and how many executions you have left based on the number of players alive. Now, we have talked about how that changes in Bad Moon Rising, but I think the really important thing is that this is just an overall change where I think that in Bad Moon Rising, you want to be executing people you think are definitely evil as often as possible. That's how you minimize the chance of having weird timing things, like you have the demon as a potential candidate, but you don't execute them right away, and the DA, Devil's Advocate, is still alive, so you end up not being able to execute them on the final day. You can avoid that sort of situation by just more heavily prioritizing killing evil players. It's also an effective way to play around the mastermind. A lot of groups I've seen are very afraid of executing a player when you've had a night of no deaths, even if you can... I've seen often you can sort of deduce that it's unlikely that you killed the demon the previous day. And in that case, I think it's you lose a lot by wasting an execution, whereas you can just go after players you think are evil, and even if it is a mastermind day, if you're still killing an evil player, it still works out for you. So I think in terms of good team strategy, this is something that's changed a little bit from maybe things I've said in other episodes, which is, like, there's a lot of good characters that are happy to be tested, sort of, in Bad Moon Rising. But I almost feel like those tests should be done incidentally. Like, you shouldn't seek them out. You should be happy when a player survives execution and it's explainable by their ability and therefore you learn from it. But you shouldn't intentionally cause that to happen that much. The notable exception is probably Tea Lady. Tea Lady's just so strong that executing their neighbors to test them is usually a good idea, I think. And there's a lot of ways, different ways to go about it. But in terms of the other ones, like Fool and Sailor, I don't really think it's worthwhile to seek them out and execute them just to test them. I think it's far better to just put a priority on killing players you think are evil for whatever reason. And if they happen to be those characters, well, the nice benefit of their ability is that when you execute them and they don't die, they have a reason to explain it. So yeah, that was just one thing that I was thinking about in general. You don't know the number of executions, and there's a lot of things that can sort of interfere with how many executions you have left, but just always prioritizing evil players means that you don't really have to worry about whether you're using your executions efficiently to generate information, because, well, that's generating good information by eliminating evil candidates, and it's also the least risky thing in terms of making sure the game doesn't end unexpectedly. So that's general strategy idea for the good team. I also had one for the evil team. On the evil team, it's often very good to get an outsider executed on the first day, is what I've noticed. And this is just an observation from a lot of games where I've seen evil win after getting an outsider executed on the first day. There's two really big reasons for this. It's quite good if you have a godfather, for obvious reasons. You'll get an extra kill in the night, which does mean you have to coordinate, but you can usually do that on the first day. If it's a moonchild, that's also helpful, because that'll be even another death. And even if you don't have a godfather, it can still help confuse the number of deaths if you've executed an outsider right away, because you have to try to figure out if there's a godfather or not. So if you have a Shabaloth or something, you might be able to keep up the ruse that it's some other demon while still getting those two kills in because you executed an outsider. It's also good because one of the strongest townsfolk, the professor, won't have a resurrection target. So one of the strongest things the professor can do is just revive the person who was executed on the first day. That accomplishes two things. One, it proves that they are townsfolk, and two, it proves that the professor is the professor, or at least one of the people claiming professor is the professor, because that's too early for a Shabaloth to have regurgitated them. If you execute an outsider on the first day, you are delaying the professor ability, and that means there's more time to kill the professor before they get to use their powerful ability, and there's also it's also possible to make it look like a Shabaloth, whereas you can't do that if they just resurrect the first executed player. So yeah, I think lots of benefits to executing an outsider on the first day for the evil team. Obviously, you can flip this and say to the good team, probably don't execute an outsider on the first day. And, you know, you always got to consider the downstream meta effects of if outsiders are always surviving the first day, do those just become really good, like, minion bluffs and stuff like that? But I think just on a basic level, if on the first day you're choosing between a couple of suspicious people, I think in a lot of other scripts, you'll tend towards executing the outsiders because they don't have, like, strong ongoing abilities. But I think in Bad Moon Rising, the combination of Godfather and Professor, those two things make it so that there's a pretty heavy tax for executing an outsider. So I would generally avoid it. Of course, with all things, there's exceptions. You know, I'm always cautious to say something too strongly on here because there are plenty of times when you will happily execute an outsider on the first day. While we're talking about Professor, we can talk about a sort of uncommon professor strategy, which is that as the professor, you can technically choose people that you don't know are dead, but you think are dead, and the storyteller will just shake their head no if you've actually chosen someone who's alive. You don't use your ability because you can only actually target dead players, and usually the storyteller will put you to sleep if they realize you're just fishing for dead players for too long. But if you want to just like try it for a night and try to predict who's going to die in the night, a good target for this is a fool who is executed on the first day. So if you do the thing where you execute a fool on the first day to try to prove them, and then you're a professor who doesn't have a target on that first night, I think it's actually quite a decent thing to do to just try to resurrect that fool again, even though they're not dead, because they were saved by their own ability. Because either you're just told, no, they're actually still alive, in which case, okay, you didn't waste anything. Or they're dead, and you can prove that they're good the next day by trying to re-execute them again. So it confirms them to you, because you wouldn't be legally allowed to target them unless they were dead. So you'll know in the morning when they're just still alive that you saved them. You lose the confirmation of yourself, because to everyone else it just looks like they went into that night alive and then came out of it alive. So you do lose that. But I think the benefits can outweigh that. So one benefit is that you've used your ability successfully and you haven't died yet. You end up getting a net of 2 nights of protection for one use of your ability. So if you think of the professor as like you stop a death, which you kind of do by reversing a death, if you're resurrecting the fool, that's a great person to resurrect because the demon has to kill them twice. So it's hard for them to deal with that player. And they're like confirmed to you. So you're very likely to end up with that confirmed player alive for a long time, which just limits the execution space and makes you more likely to execute players who are, you know, evil. And it's also kind of a sneaky protection because the demon who targets them might think that they were protected by an innkeeper, or maybe they're the sailor who is pretending to be the fool, and the demon might not want to target them again for those reasons. So even though it is just the fool's own ability that saved them, the demon doesn't know that you've confirmed that player, and you sort of like make yourself their grandmother in a sense, or like a washroom or something, where now you know that you can confirm them, but nobody else knows that. And in general, that just can create a confirmation chain that is quite good later on. And I think I mentioned this when I first started talking about it, but you can always re-execute them the next day if you really want to. You will know that they will survive that second execution, which will 100% confirm them as good. And also, in all likelihood, it will confirm you. So that's not a terrible option. I still think it's probably not worth going for it, because you'd rather just have them have that extra life that they can use later. But if the town really wants to confirm them, they can get 100% confirmed good player by executing them and having them survive 2 days in a row. So to talk about something we got slightly wrong on an episode, I think it was the Puka episode, or maybe the Gambler episode, we talked about how Puka can kind of ruin 2 nights of info for the Gambler when they kill them, whereas most demons only ruin 1, which is the night the Gambler actually dies. That's not really true, because that was just a mistaken night order thing. Turns out the Gambler goes before Puka in the night order, so if they gamble wrong on the night that the Puka targets them, they're just going to die that night, even though they're poisoned, because they get poisoned after they kill themselves with their own ability. So really, the Puka doesn't interfere with the Gambler any more than it than any other demon interferes with the Gambler on the night that the Gambler dies. So yeah, that's just a slight correction. It's obvious if you look at the night order, but I think we overstated a little bit how much the Gambler is affected by the Puka. In fact, it's basically one of the only characters that isn't really affected at all, because it goes before the Puka. So either they're going to be like slated to die that night anyway, in which case they're going to die no matter how they gamble, which is the time they're gambling when they're poisoned, or they're going to gamble before they're poisoned. So yeah, Puka versus Gambler. Gambler's kind of immune to Puka, in a weird way. Speaking of Puka, a strategy idea I had is that you can target the Moonchild that night after they've made their choice. So when the Moonchild's died and they choose a player, if you target them at night, you can make them drunk or poisoned, and then the good player that they chose won't die, and that can make them look suspicious. In terms of times when this is going to be useful, you're giving up a lot, right? You're giving up 2 nights of death, where you're sinking your own kill for the next night and you're removing the Moonchild's kill for the current night. So that's a lot of death to give up, but one of them is in the future. If you're in a situation like it's late in the game and you think it's more important to keep an execution target alive, and the Moonchild just chose like the other prime suspect aside from you, it might be worth doing this to keep that suspect alive, just to waste an execution. It's going to be rare that you want to do this, because it does take up those 2 deaths. But sometimes one extra execution target towards the end of the game can be worth it. Especially if you can, you know, use that Knight of No Death to make a Devil's Advocate lineup so that they're protecting you or something like that. All right, let's talk about a weird character interaction that I had never thought about before, but I think someone posted on the unofficial Discord and I saw it and I was like, wait a minute, that's very devious and maybe could be fun sometimes. This one I'm going to say take with a big grain of salt, because it's the sort of thing that could easily be unfun if you do it at the wrong time, which is with a tinker. They say if the tinker died during the day, then, well, or they can die at any time. It's the godfather that says if an outsider died during the day, the godfather will get to kill the next night. So what you can technically do is when you're announcing players who died in the night, you can announce them as like so-and-so is dead, so-and-so is dead, and so-and-so is dead, and have one of those be the Tinker who literally just died as you were saying it during the day. But to everyone else, it's indistinguishable from them dying, having died at night. Should you ever do this? I'm not sure. But it's something to think about. It'll give the Godfather an extra kill the next night, which, if players aren't thinking along these lines, if they aren't thinking about it being possible for the Tinker to have died during the day when you're announcing their death at dawn, if players aren't thinking of that, they could easily see it as unfair and like they had no chance to figure out that that is what happened. So do this with caution. Do this maybe if your players already know that this is a possibility. I would honestly recommend probably just not doing this, but I thought it was interesting enough that I wanted to bring it up. Announcing the Tinker with the other night deaths, but actually that Tinker was a day death. I've got a couple of points on chambermaid here. First one is that when you're bluffing a chambermaid, bluffing with a one is the most likely successful bluff. And the reason for that is that neither of the players you pointed to is going to be able to prove you wrong, or at least like to themselves be able to prove you wrong, because no matter what, whether they woke or not, they can just think the other person is lying. So if you say a zero and either of them woke up in the night, they know that you're lying or drunk or whatever. If you said a two and either of them didn't wake up, they again know that you're drunk or lying or whatever. If you say a one and they didn't wake up, no matter what the other person's claiming, the other person's either claiming to have woken up, in which case your info looks correct, or they're claiming that they didn't wake up, in which case your info looks wrong, but they can just assume the other person's lying. And similar for if you say a one and they did wake up, they can always assume the other person's lying. So yeah, just in general, a one is the most likely bluff for you to get away with. And I think that if you're like bluffing, say, your first night info, one is generally a safe bet, or at least safer than the other options. Another point on chambermaid is that a lot of players will try to play around the chambermaid as evil by bluffing that they wake in their own wake patterns. And I just wanted to point out that chambermaid can still be strong in this instance because they can kind of confirm themselves by calling out players' wake patterns, even if they're not calling out people as evil by like bluffing the incorrect wake patterns, if evil's just bluffing things that wake in the exact same patterns they do. The fact that the chambermaid correctly calls out wake patterns when they don't know people's characters is still sort of self-confirmation for the chambermaid. And so that's a reason that keeping your characters secret can be nice, so that the chambermaid doesn't know what number they should be getting from you. So that'll be a way to distinguish real chambermaid from fake ones. And that's something that'll work even if evil is bluffing specifically around the chambermaid. So I think that's an interesting idea about the ability. Like, you can get more utility out of it by actively concealing your roles, and that's counterplay to evil's counterplay, counterplay. It's very similar to, like, an Undertaker or something, where they're more effective when they don't know the roles of the players who were executed. All right, moving on. Sorry for jumping around so much here. I am kind of just going based on some scattered notes that I took while editing episodes, so they're not really in any particular order, just the order that they occurred to me in the episodes. So, talking about Poe, there's a lot of fancy things you can do with Poe in terms of choosing to kill one or zero or three, sinking kills sometimes. I think there's also a lot of benefit to just killing nobody, then killing three players, then killing nobody, then three, then nobody, then three. I think it's kind of an underrated strategy. It is very basic. It's kind of the most obvious way to play Poe, and it'll make it the most obvious that the Poe is in play. If you think there's not a courtier, then this is, I think, pretty strong still. If there is a courtier, it's going to be a little bit rough because they're just going to be able to call you out pretty easily. But if you think there isn't one, then I think there's an overlooked aspect of this that makes it extra strong. And this is part of the reason that Poe is just very strong in general. So on the first day, the good team has to make an execution. Then you kill nobody. Then the good team has to make another execution. Between those two executions, they have learned nothing about which players the evil team wants dead. So that is depriving the town of information that they could otherwise be using to make a more educated execution. So we often talk about how like the deaths and lack of deaths in BMR is information. It's also just information with like, oh, this player was killed, so maybe they like knew something, maybe their ability had the potential of uncovering some evil. If you don't kill anyone, the good team doesn't get that. So I think that's a little hidden benefit that people don't really think about that much, is that if you just follow this pattern every single time, you're forcing the good team to make two executions before they learn who it is you wanted dead. You're also giving yourself extra time to think about who you want dead. So you can see two executions of what the town is thinking. And that can allow you to make better choices at night to kill the players that are the least suspicious. And one final note here, and this is on bluffing as the professor. If you just say that you attempted to resurrect whoever died first, then this is a decent thing to do as the professor because it insulates you against there being a real professor in the game. I say this because this is often one of the best things for a real professor to do. So if you say that you attempted it, there's a good chance that if there's a real professor, they also attempted to resurrect that same player. And they got, well, the same result as you, because either that player's alive now and you have two people claiming to be professor, both who could explain why they're alive and you can't trust either of them. Or you have two people claiming to be professor, both of whom failed, and again, you can't trust either of them. So it's just it deprives the professor of the self-confirming part of their ability if you can claim to have used their ability in the same way on the same night. And the most predictable way to do that is to claim to just have attempted to resurrect whoever died first. Now, this has the chance of very much backfiring on you if you make that claim and then the real professor actually saved their ability and resurrects somebody later, because at that point, they're going to be the only explanation for why that player's alive. So it'll be confirming that player, it'll be confirming themselves, and it'll be confirming that you are evil. So, risky strategy, but it's always risky bluffing, professor, because professor's a really hard role to bluff. So if you're going to do it, I say maximize that your chance of at least ruining the credibility of the real professor, if there is one. All right, that about wraps it up for the things we missed in Bad Moon Rising. I know this is a lot of just me talking at you, which is an unusual thing for an episode, but we'll be back to having guests soon, don't worry, with whatever other topics come up that I decide to talk about. I have a few ideas already, but if you have things that you're interested in hearing about, please email them to me. You can find my email in the podcast show notes for every episode. It's cultoftheclocktower@gmail.com. Let me know there, or on Reddit, or in the unofficial Discord, or whatever. You can find me lots of places on the internet. But yeah, thanks for listening, and thanks for sticking around for 3 seasons of Cult of the Clock Tower. And I hope you'll enjoy what we have planned in the future. Turns out when I'm the only person on the episode, I still don't know how to end the episode. So, bye. Goodbye. Talk to you in a month or so.